From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Tejano singer Bobby Pulido is using his voice in a new way running for Congress, and how the tuba is saving kids in the Rio Grande Valley.
Support for this podcast of Texas Matters comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. By investing in local communities and rewarding policyholders for prioritizing safety, they are building a more resilient Texas. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. South Texas is again on the political front lines. The 15th Congressional District, stretching from the border city of McAllen through Hidalgo County and north towards Seguin just outside of San Antonio, has become a symbol of the shifting political winds of the region. Once a reliable Democratic stronghold, the district flipped Republican in recent elections, and in 2024, Donald Trump carried it by a wide margin. In the coming midterms, Democrats are looking for a comeback, and one of the candidates stepping into that fight is a familiar voice, not from politics, but from music. Bobby Pulido, the Tejano singer, is trading the stage for the campaign trail. I spoke with Bobby Pulido about why he's running for Congress and what are the solutions that he offers for South Texas.
Well, I mean, ever since I was younger, when I was in college, that's kind of what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a lawyer and study political science. I was always fascinated with politics since I was younger. And, you know, I had aspirations when I was younger to one day run for office. But, you know, music got in the way. And I followed that path for 30 years. And, you know, kind of came to this point. And I was traveling around on election day with Vicente Gonzalez, a friend of mine who was running for Congress, and I got to hang out with him for the day and his wife, Lorena, and she kind of threw the bug in my ear and says, well, you know so much about politics, why don't you run? And so I said, well, that was always what I wanted to do. I said, but I love my life. And, you know, she kind of threw that in there, and that kind of spurred it on. And then the things started happening in the country that I didn't like the direction that we were going. And, you know, like any armchair political fan, I have my ideas on how to fix things and what things should happen and what's wrong with the world. But, you know, your voice doesn't matter if you're just somebody with an opinion. So I thought long and hard about it and said, you know, I think I'm going to told my wife, I had to talk with my wife, and said, I'm thinking about making that plunge. She was very surprised, but at the same time not, because she knows that that's something that I follow closely. She said, well, you're very passionate about it. And I'm like, yeah. And so, you know, thought long hard and decided that I wanted to try to take back this seat.
So you are running as a Democrat. Talk about your values, how they align with the Democratic Party.
You know, look, the Democratic ideologies, and not just party ideologies, are constantly shifting. You know, we used to be the Dixiecrats. There was not that long ago, Ronald Reagan and you know, George W. Bush were free traders, and now it's like, It's America first, and things are constantly in flux in politics. And you mentioned something real important, which is values. I think the values are the things that shouldn't move. I think values need to be the your central core as a candidate that guide you. I think South Texas values is very, very distinct. South Texas has a way of being. That's why there's the saying 956. It's a thing, you know. We're kind of in a bubble here in South Texas, especially in the Rio Grande Valley. Not all of South Texas, but it's the Tejano culture that we have, and I'll tell you, you know, there's certain things that have been changing over time that have kind of, I don't think we've defended what we stood for, and I think as a Democrat, I think that we've kind of let the other side define us, and unfairly. And I think that if anything I can say, a criticism towards what the Democratic Party has done is they kind of took the vote for granted. They kind of always thought that they just vote for them just because. And that's not the case. And I blame a lot of things for that. I think Citizens United in 2010, kind of around that time is when the shift started happening. It was very small, but then it started growing. As Democrats, we had to try to compete to win elections, and we went to the same well where Republicans have always gone, which is big businesses for money. And I think that that's kind of put the whole party system on both sides off kilter. So now you have, both parties catering to corporate America and to their whims at the expense of the people.
Why do you think the Republican Party has been doing so much better in South Texas?
They invested. They invested. I mean, I will tell you, they put out the Libra initiative. They did a lot of things. They started running candidates. They would run candidates that they knew were going to lose. I mean, imagine they play the long game, and they've been doing this for a long time. And I think that the Democratic Party was asleep at the wheel, to be honest with you, and really didn't, ever since Trump came in 2016, we didn't really ever define what we stood for. We just tried to define what we were against. And I don't think that's a smart way of doing things. And I'm telling you, I mean, I'm not, my message is not to go out there and just talk smack about Trump, even though I didn't vote for the guy, right? And I don't support his policies. My ideas are the things that I'm going to go out there, what I'm going to fight for, which is, affordable health care, because it's not. And to be quite honest, I'm a straight shooter and I like to tell it like it is. I think both parties have kind of not done a good job when it came to health care and the health care costs. I think Obamacare was great and that it covered a lot of people that didn't have health insurance, but he brought those health insurance companies to the table to write Obamacare. And it just made it more expensive on the middle class. And, the really rich people, they don't want to pay taxes anyway, so they dump it on the middle class. But I also remember when Trump was 2 weeks away from giving us a plan on healthcare and how he was going to fix it. And we're still waiting, I might add. Those 2 weeks have been pretty long. So at the end of the day, we have to make it a priority to fix this, because at the pace that we're going, like next year, they want to increase premiums again 20%. And the middle class can't take it. They just can't. It's getting to the point right now where a lot of people are just risking where they just get off of healthcare because it's so expensive, and they're prioritizing other things. And I think that's going to be a recipe for disaster for the country.
There are a lot of needs in South Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley. Families are struggling. Food prices continue to rise. Energy prices continue to rise. Yes. There's a lot of water needs in a lot of these communities in the area. They don't have access to reliable sources of clean water. There are so many needs. Do you think that you're able to provide solutions?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm running for U.S. Congress, and you have one voice and one vote out of 435. That voice is important, and you have to use that voice to try to offer solutions and try to convince your fellow Congress people that your ideas are good. It's not president; it's a different type of position that you're running for. But it's important to have that voice and to use that voice. Everything that you're saying requires investment, right? The water solution is going to be an investment issue. It's very expensive. It's a very expensive thing. And I will tell you, as long as we keep giving those rich corporations and those rich billionaires tax cuts, there will not be an investment. It's not going to come. Who's going to pay for that? Those investments, they don't grow on trees. They don't just fall from the sky. It's something, and they try to gaslight the people and to say, no, it's all those poor people that are taking all this money from us. It's not true. They have continually gotten breaks. And what do? They go buy more stocks, stock buybacks. At some point, that is going to blow up in our face and it's going to be unsustainable. And so I think the first step in solution is to have a better monetary policy and tax policy. I think that the last president that balanced the budget was a Democrat, Bill Clinton, because he actually raised taxes on the corporations. That's like not a novel idea, but nobody has the courage to do so because they're in bed with them. And the truth of the matter is we're going to need the people to get involved because that's the only way we can compete. And I say this because it's very expensive to run a campaign. And if we don't have the people involved, fighting for their interests, it's very hard because there's so much money on the corporate side that they get what they want. And it's just a damn shame.
So when you go out and campaign, will you be performing, or how is that going to work?
No. I did a ranch hall last night. I sang one song at the end. We talked about policy, and I sang one song at the end. But it's not. I mean, it was an acoustic one. It was just accordion and bajo sexto. So it wasn't like a full-fledged concert. Not that.
What's wrong with that? I mean, you can have both, can't you?
Well,
concerts and talking about politics. That's what a rally can be like.
yes, it can, but I'm not going to give away all my secrets right now.
Are you thinking you have to lure people back to the Democratic Party?
No doubt. Not lure. I think luring is like if you're throwing bait out there and trying to trick them. I don't see it that way. There's a lot of people that I'll tell you, there's a big myth that South Texas is red. South Texas is not red. They voted for President Trump over Kamala Harris. That's it. This is not complicated. And a lot of people point out to Stark County and talk about Stark County. Well, Stark County, the congressman from Stark County, Henry Cuellar, won 69% of the vote there. That's a pretty astoundingly overwhelming victory for a Democrat. Now, he's the type of Democrat that people like in the South. And I think as a party, we could learn a lot from Henry Cuellar when it comes to representing the values of South Texas. And he's been able to consistently do that, right? To win in areas that vote for Trump, but they voted for him. He is a conservative Democrat. I think a lot of people down here are very culturally conservative. That's just the way of life down here. And I don't think it should be a bad word. I think as a party, if we're the party as Democrats of inclusivity, we should also be inclusive on inclusivity of thought and be a bigger tent because that's the way to win. I promise you that.
Bobby Pulido is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the 15th Congressional District of Texas, which covers a section of South Texas. Writer Sam Quiñones is known for Dreamland and The Least of Us. He's turning from documenting the grim stories of the opioid crisis to a more joyful subject, the tuba. His new book is The Perfect Tuba, Forging Fulfillment from the Bass Horn, Band, and Hard Work. In it, he explores the history of the instrument, its role in American music, and the communities that it sustains. Quiñones traveled across the U.S., meeting tubists, band directors, and students who embodied the values of discipline, perseverance, and joy. Central to his argument is that music education and community bands are an antidote to isolation and despair. He frames the tuba as the foundation of sound and spirit in multiple traditions, from classical orchestras to marching bands to regional popular music, like in South Texas.
I had spent 12 years writing about people trying to find you know, happiness from something they buy, which also happens to be almost like the central message of American corporate marketing, right? And people who are kind of grinding their lives into dust over finding these substances. I wanted to write about people who were finding fulfillment from something they created, principally something they created from their own capabilities, capabilities that they honed through practice, through hard work, through perseverance despite failure, and especially through collaboration with others. I felt that was almost like the key to part of the solution to the opioid epidemic was to turn into that kind of pursuit. And I found that at first in tuba players. Tuba players spend huge amounts of time of their lives perfecting things through attention to detail, persevering despite failure, all without really much expectation of acclaim or wealth or fame of any kind. And to me, this was something really, really special. It's almost like the antidote to addiction and a consumer culture of distraction and the pursuit of dopamine rushes through outrage was quietly, persistently focusing on improving your own skills, and through that, finding your own passion, finding this fulfillment that is more enduring and powerful, really, in the long run than any drug. So I began to focus on tuba players. That's how the whole project started.
So how did you come to the tuba? There could have been lots of things that you could have focused on to highlight community building and resilience. So how did this ungainly instrument become so important to understanding the antidote to the despair and isolation of addiction, finding something that brings communities together? Why the tuba?
Well, years ago, when I was at the LA Times, this was about 2011, I wrote a couple of stories about the importance of the tuba in Mexican LA. The tuba, when I grew up in LA, when I was growing up, the guitar was the thing. Everybody played the guitar. Well, now, at least in Mexican LA, the tuba is the instrument. It's hugely popular, very important instrument in backyard parties. People hire bandas for their backyard parties, for quinceañeras, for birthdays, for weddings, and so on. And I wrote about this and how trumpet players were now switching to the tuba because they got paid triple what the trumpet gets paid. Now, I put that story out, and then the very day when it appeared on the front page of the LA Times, a band director calls me and he says, you know what, you're so right. This has been going on for a while. It's a remarkable thing. But one of the effects is that all the high schools in the area now are getting their tubas stolen. And sure enough, there was a rash of tuba thefts going on across Mexican LA, in which all these high school bands were losing these very expensive tubas. A bad tuba cost $2,000, you know. And so I wrote that story too. And after that, for reasons I cannot tell you, Dave, I just began to interview tuba players. I don't play the tuba. I was never in marching band. But, you know, as a journalist, I have known that if you find people devoted to a pursuit, regardless of whether or not it's going to make them famous or wealthy, but just for the pure love of it, if you stick with those stories, if you stick with those people, you will find some amazing, amazing stories there. And that's what I did. As I was writing about heroin and then fentanyl and methamphetamine and all this horrible stories about our epidemic of addiction nationwide, I at the same time was interviewing tuba players, not with much focus, just saying, okay, let's see what this guy has to say or this person over here has to say. And so little by little, I just accumulated a whole tuba file on my computer. And when the last book was done, The Least of Us, which charts the spread of fentanyl and methamphetamine from the drug traffickers in Mexico, and of course the horrible addiction and death that ensues and all that, I wanted to write about something else, and my agent says, maybe you should see what you could do finally with that whole bunch of interviews about tuba players. And so I did. I began to really dig into it. I began to re-interview people. I began to talk to new folks that I'd found. And especially, I would say, one trip in particular to the International Tuba Euphonium Conference, which takes place every 2 years in the United States. This one was in Phoenix. I met up with some tuba professors at the universities in the Rio Grande Valley and in Kingsville. And they were the ones who then broadened the scope of my book. Through conversations with them, they told me, we brought each of us like 20 tuba player teaching tuba students here to this thing. I was like, how many students do you have? Isn't it, you know, can you really find work for all these guys playing tuba? And, they said, well, the thing is that they all go back, they're all from the Rio Grande Valley, and they're not aiming to be tuba performance majors. Their aim is to become band directors. They're almost all going to go back home to the Rio Grande Valley and become band directors. And that shifted the focus, because in time I realized that band directors and tuba players have a lot in common. Some of the basics are really common to both of them. They're both put in huge amounts of work, immense precision to detail, patience and perseverance, collaborating with others, and without really the expectation of great acclaim or money. For band directors, it's the payment is so often for these immense hours that these band directors work. It's seeing the light go on in their kids' eyes that just motivates them and keeps these remarkable band directors working for years and years. And so that kind of expanded the story once I realized that, and once I began to start poking into the stories of the high school bands in Roma and Lopez High in Brownsville.
In Roma, Texas, you write about the marching band director, Al Cordinez. He builds a powerhouse program in that small border town. How did he do that?
He realized, first of all these kids, none of these kids can afford or could afford back then, certainly, music lessons. And in fact, even if they could afford one, they couldn't find teachers, because Roma is so isolated. It's probably the most isolated of all the Rio Grande Valley towns. What he realized is that we will never be able to compete with as a powerhouse, which we have to be in order to compete against drug traffickers. Drug traffickers were an immense allure for a lot of kids in his at Roma High. And so he realized that the band needed to be this counterbalance. And the only way to do that was to make sure that the band got much better. And the only way to do that was to see if you could devise a system whereby the band directors themselves were the teachers that the kids could not afford. But what that meant was you had to hire a whole lot more band directors than most schools had at the time. So he convinced, didn't take much work, but he convinced a new superintendent and a new school board president, Eloy Vera, and Walter Watson was the superintendent, that this was necessary. And they began to make that investment in band. They hired eventually 10 band directors for this one high school. I don't think at the time there was any high school in Texas with that many band directors. But the idea was that these teachers each would teach one instrument, flute, French horn, drums, tuba, whatever. And they would teach kids from sixth grade all the way up to 12th grade. So kids in that instrument would have the same teacher for all of those grades. And if you focused on the youngsters and got them off with really solid foundation in music, by the time they were in 10th, 11th, 12th grade, they were much, much better than the kids that were able to achieve under the current system in Roma, which had three band directors, I think, at the time. This system took a few years to put in place, but very quickly Cortinas and his team, with this band experiment that they were starting, really, really began to see immense improvement. And that built enthusiasm, and things began to really begin to change. At one point, they were doing so well. Very soon after this, this little town's band was invited to speak at the massive Texas Music Educators Association meeting in San Antonio in February, where I think 25, 30,000 people attend this conference. And they gave a whole standing room only speech about what they were doing in this tiny, most impoverished towns in Texas, what they were doing to create this new band culture. And the story that I write in the book is about the first time the Roma band competed on the field of the Alamo Dome there in San Antonio, in the state championships. It was just all these kids had never been even to San Antonio. Someone had never stayed in a hotel. People, they were so far from all of this, and yet they go out there, and through just intense training and really having been trained in their instruments from the very, very young age, I tell the story of how they just walk onto the field, and it's just remarkable. It says it makes me almost want to cry thinking about it. It's this remarkable story of how you see that there's value there, and then you put immense effort, band directors and the kids, into honing it. And so when it comes time to really produce in front of thousands of people and 12 and 11 other finalist bands, that you're able to pull it off. And so it was this beautiful, to me, it was like this beautiful story that I also had not expected, not really expected to find these stories among tuba players either, but it was just this beautiful story of exactly what I'm talking about, the hard work, the perseverance, the persistence in spite of failure, and of course, obviously, the collaboration with others, you know, and all of those kids, many of the, for example, almost the entire tuba low brass section went to college. Many of those kids in Roma, the connection with Mexico is very strong. It's a very short walk across a small pedestrian bridge to get to Mexico. These kids were, this was just as the cartel wars were beginning down in Mexico. These kids eventually are going to college just as the real savage violence is kicking off. Many of their friends were murdered. And here these kids are going up to Kingsville to study tuba. And get away from all that. And many of them indeed are back now in Roma years later teaching band.
So how did the tuba become cool?
In Roma, I think, and in the Rio Grande Valley, it became cool because the bands got so much better. And all of a sudden it wasn't just the athletes who got the props. It was the band directors, the band, you know, there became a kind of a coolness, and also the parents began to be really interested, and they became a significant booster club, and they wanted their kids. They saw the violence taking place right across the border, and all of a sudden, being in band became this amazing, life-saving almost option for a lot of people. Once the band got really good in Roma, all of a sudden it got really good again. You know, I mean, people began to really dive into it, and it became a thing that was no longer kind of cornball, and you know, it's still, for some people, it's still band nerds, that kind of stuff, but in Roma it's got a whole other context, which is almost life-saving.
Sam Quiñones is the author of The Perfect Tuba. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org, and you can find us wherever you get cool podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.